Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, who assesses the viability of talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban, and hard decisions facing President Obama on the future of the nine-year-old Afghan war. Conrad Schneider, advocacy director of the Clean Air Task Force, who describes the efforts now being made to clean up dangerous pollution produced at coal-burning power plants across the U.S. And Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses increasing poverty in the U.S. and what's at stake for economic policy in this year's congressional election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A group of high-level retired Chinese communist elders have boldly called to end China's extensive restrictions on free speech. A letter signed by 23 retired Chinese officials was released days after Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo was awarded the 2010 Nobel Peace Prize for 20 years of work promoting human rights. Posted online, the letter by the elders accuses current Chinese officials of violating China's 1982 constitution, which guarantees freedom of speech, despite the government having restricted those rights with layers of laws and regulations. Among the signers of the letter, Wang Yongcheng, a retired professor at Shanghai's Jiaotong University, told the Associated Press, "If the constitution is violated, the government will lack legitimacy. The people must assert and exercise their legitimate rights." Censorship in China has become so severe that speeches by Premier Wang Jiabao urging political reforms are removed from official media reports. The final authority on what can be published rests with the Communist Party's highly secretive Central Propaganda Department, which regularly notifies editors by phone to avoid leaving a paper trail what topics are off-limits to discuss. Members of the group have signed other letters in the past and, ironically, were once responsible themselves for enforcing strict censorship. The British anti-corruption organization Global Witness reports top British and other banks, including Barclays, HSBC, Royal Bank of Scotland, and UBS, have long ties with corrupt Nigerian politicians who have fleeced the West African country of its natural resources and miring Nigeria in poverty. These banks held accounts for two state governors in Nigeria who sent illicit funds to the UK, financing their extravagant lifestyle. Global Witness also reports the same banks took tens of millions of dollars in the late 1990s from former Nigerian dictator Sani Abacha. The dictator had accounts in the UK, Switzerland, Luxembourg, and the United States. So far, England's top bank regulator, the Financial Services Authority, has not publicly fined or even named any bank for engaging in corrupt practices. This stands in stark contrast with the United States, which has levied hundreds of millions of dollars in fines against banks for corrupt behavior. Nigeria, which earned over $370 billion in oil and gas exports since 2000, is seen as one of the world's worst victims of the natural resources curse. Despite its oil wealth, most Nigerians struggle for survival, and half the country lacks clean drinking water. In 1997, Republican pollster Frank Luntz advised GOP leaders to appeal directly to Latino voters or face political oblivion. In 2004, George W. Bush got the message and ran Spanish-language ads and won over 40% of the Hispanic vote. All that changed in 2008 when Barack Obama won two-thirds of the Latino vote and Republicans embraced anti-immigrant policies. But the White House and congressional Democrats have failed to push ahead on immigration reform, endangering the loyalty of Latino voters. Instead, Democrats adopted a more conservative, enforcement-first approach and have geared up to deport up to 400,000 undocumented immigrants a year. According to the American Prospect magazine, the deep recession has cut the flow of illegal immigrants to 300,000, down from an annual average of 850,000. But the number of immigrants from Latin America dying in the hot deserts of Arizona is still growing due to the increased difficulty in crossing. The administration has not increased the number of green cards or work permits for low-income workers. Republican political operatives appear to be gambling this year that congressional Democrats will be afraid to push ahead on comprehensive immigration reform out of a fear of alienating white blue-collar voters suffering from high unemployment. If that comes to pass, Democrats risk disappointing Latino voters whose numbers are expected to double by 2050. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As U.S. and NATO troops fighting in Afghanistan see a record number of military and civilian casualties in the nine-year-old war, news reports indicate that the Afghan government and the Taliban may be taking the first tentative steps toward negotiations. U.S. officials have confirmed that they are providing safe passage to Taliban leaders traveling to the capital city of Kabul to initiate peace talks with representatives of Afghan President Hamid Karzai. But there is skepticism that these talks will lead to any quick peace deal as violence escalates across Afghanistan between Taliban insurgents and American and NATO forces now numbering 150,000. According to U.S. military officials, the number of airstrikes and unmanned drone attacks targeting the Taliban have increased exponentially over the past 4 months. Observers believe that the escalation of the air campaign is part of a two-track strategy designed to bring more pressure on Taliban commanders in order to drive them toward a diplomatic solution. Any future negotiations between the Taliban and Afghan government will be made more difficult by the widespread perception that President Karzai's government is thoroughly corrupt. The latest indication being a decision by Afghanistan's Election Commission to throw out about 1 million ballots cast in the September 18th parliamentary election, eliminating about 23% of the votes due to fraud. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with former CIA analyst Melvin Goodman, who now serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. He assesses the viability of talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban and hard decisions facing President Obama as he and his advisors conduct a review of their Afghan war strategy in December.
Well, I don't think the negotiations are serious at this point, and I don't even believe I would use the term negotiations. I think what we're seeing are unofficial personal contacts between the Afghan government, particularly the people closest to Karzai, and certain Taliban leaders. And it's true that the Taliban has been given safe conduct so they can travel to Kabul for these talks. But when you look at the demands that the two sides are making, I don't see room for compromise right now. The Taliban is demanding that all foreign troops withdraw before there are any negotiations. And the United States is demanding that not only must the Taliban reject al-Qaeda, which wouldn't be difficult, but the Taliban must lay down their arms and declare allegiance to the Kabul government. And I don't see that happening. Right now, the Taliban are doing extremely well. They seem to have a certain amount of cohesion in the field. I think they're following a strategy. Their forces are spreading out into areas where they haven't been before, particularly the Tajik areas in the north. They're doing very well in the south and the east. Whereas you look at the United States counterinsurgency strategy, and I think it's adrift right now. If you look at what happened at Marja about 6 months ago, that was a major disappointment. The Kandahar offensive really wasn't a full-scale offensive. It had to be scaled down because the support we thought we would get from the Afghan military just was not forthcoming. So I think the only one really interested in some kind of compromise at this point is Karzai, because he doesn't know what the United States is going to do. He knows that President Obama is seriously conflicted over strategy. I mean, I'm sure he read the December 1st West Point speech just the way everyone else did. And here was a speech that talked about putting troops in, and the same speech he talked about taking them out. And then when you read Bob Woodward's Obama's Wars, which I think is a fascinating account of how that decision was made, it shows that his advisors were conflicted, including among the military, that just as many generals were pushing against introducing more troops as there were generals and admirals pushing for more troops. So it's not clear what's going to happen in December when we have this review. I'm inclined to think right now it's not going to be a serious review. And I don't expect any serious withdrawal to take place in July 2011, which is what Obama has promised and what Vice President Biden has assured people will definitely happen. So what the New York Times did a few days ago to say that the end game has begun, I think that is really premature at this point.
The topic of Afghanistan is not really a primary issue being debated in this election campaign. But despite the fact that there is not a lot of focus on the Afghan war among the American people, if you were going to make the case to the president, if you were to advise him on withdrawing troops from Afghanistan or when to do it, what case would you make in terms of national security issues and the concern among many people who've expressed this over the years, including Obama during the campaign, that we have to remain in Afghanistan in order to prevent al-Qaeda from getting a foothold there and allowing a safe haven to develop for future attacks on this country and other places around the world?
Well, I think I would talk on the basis of the mythology surrounding this decision in the first place. And I would start with al-Qaeda and the so-called safe haven in Afghanistan and the likelihood that a Taliban government would bring al-Qaeda back in. First of all, I don't think the Afghan safe haven that al-Qaeda had before 9/11 was as influential to the attack as people seem to believe. For one thing, the operational aspects of the 9/11 attacks did not take place in Afghanistan. The training took place in the United States at our own flight schools. The money for the operation was raised from sources that were based in Germany and distributed by al-Qaeda members who were in Hamburg, Germany, and a couple other German cities. And a lot of the recruiting took place in northern Africa and southern Europe. So Afghanistan itself was not that important as a safe haven. And right now, al-Qaeda has a safe haven in Pakistan. It's not necessary for them to come back into Afghanistan. There are very few al-Qaeda members in Afghanistan. The CIA director, Leon Panetta, in a briefing several months ago, put the number as 50 members of al-Qaeda, and that's probably an overstatement. And actually, right now, al-Qaeda is far more ensconced in Yemen. That seems to suggest they wouldn't need another safe haven in addition to Pakistan, given what they have in Yemen and the tribal areas of Pakistan. And then I would argue the point that this is not a war of necessity. What happens in Afghanistan is essentially limited to Afghanistan itself. The Taliban has no desire to extend its influence or power outside of Afghanistan. Omar, the Taliban leader, strictly has objectives and a mission that are defined by regaining the government in Kabul. And also, if you look at the neighbors of Afghanistan, this is a problem that the regional members should deal with. Iran certainly is opposed to the return of the Taliban. We have worked secretly with Iran before. I'm told we're still working secretly with them and bringing them into the talks that are going on now with the so-called Peace Council that it took Karzai a year to form. And the irony of this whole situation, and this would be my final point that I would make, the degree to which we are successful in Afghanistan with this counterinsurgency strategy means we would be driving the Afghan Taliban out of Afghanistan and into Pakistan, where they would ultimately join forces with the Pakistan Taliban and put more pressure on the very weak Pakistan government. So winning would be losing, as far as I'm concerned, because of the Pakistan problem that would be created.
That was former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and adjunct professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book is titled Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Read his articles online at ciponline.org. In September, the Clean Air Task Force released a report titled The Toll from Coal, an updated assessment of death and disease from America's dirtiest energy source. The report noted that emissions from coal-fired power plants contribute to global warming, ozone smog, acid rain, regional haze, and, perhaps most consequential of all, from a public health standpoint, fine particle pollution. One estimate cited in the study found that while 13,200 deaths in the U.S. were attributable to fine particle pollution in 2010, that figure was nearly double for deaths linked to coal-fired power plants in 2004. The health consequences were reduced, the report finds, due to cleanup efforts targeting coal-burning facilities at the state and federal levels, but much more still needs to be done. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Conrad Schneider, Advocacy Director of the Clean Air Task Force, about the latest developments and some of the contradictions inherent for those living near coal extraction sites when it is cleaned up for burning in plants often hundreds of miles away.
Since 2004, probably the biggest news is that the sulfur dioxide pollution and the nitrogen oxide pollution from power plants has been cut in half nationally. And the reason for that is the installation of about 130 new emission control devices. Typically, they're called scrubbers. And as a result of that reduction in pollution, the number of deaths, for example, that are due to coal-fired particulate pollution has dropped from the 2004 level, which is 24,000, down to a little over 13,000 in this year. So that's the good news. But the bad news is that 13,000 people dying prematurely from coal plant pollution is still far too many, and it's unacceptably high. And what this report also basically points to is that we can finish this job. By installing over 100 scrubbers, we were able to cut pollution in half without noticing any increase in electricity prices, natural gas prices, without seeing any problems with reliability in the power system. It means we can go further, and if we are resolute about cleaning up the rest of the plants, you know, we can finish the job of reducing this toll from coal.
When I was in West Virginia last year, I met folks who said that as requirements for cleaner coal for power plants went into effect, the coal was cleaned near where it was mined, and the cleanup left their communities with even more toxic pollution. Does the Clean Air Task Force have a position on whether coal should be phased out as soon as possible, or do you just want to clean it up?
You know, I think the fact of the matter is whether from cradle to grave, coal is a pretty dirty fuel, a pretty damaging, you know, the most environmentally damaging fuel that we have. We put out a report several years ago, actually called Cradle to Grave, which documented all of the different ways in which coal is devastating to the environment. And when you allude to the notion that in West Virginia that the coal has to be cleaner when it's delivered to the power plants, that some of the residue is left behind, that's exactly right. And people call it spray and pray because they treat the coal and then they move it out. The problem is that nationally half of our power comes from coal, and in West Virginia almost 100% of it comes from coal. And wishing is not going to make that go away. I guess our position, as long as we're going to have coal, then there needs to be tightly regulated so that its emissions and its waste products and so forth do as little to foul the environment as possible as we're transitioning to a cleaner energy economy.
Conrad Schneider, what about the dangers of coal ash? Does your organization address that?
A little over 10 years ago, we brought a petition to have actually it was still in the Clinton administration, to deal with the problem of the disposal of coal ash. In this country, every year, the residue from burning of coal, the scrubbing of coal, all the different byproducts that come as a result of coal burning create enough ash, if you want to call it that, or waste, to fill the Grand Canyon every year. And the stuff is being put into slurry ponds, unlined landfills, backfilled into mines, such a volume of it, they're putting it wherever they can potentially find to put it. It's coming out of our ears. And it is full of heavy metals and toxics. And we believe that it should be treated as it is, as a hazardous waste by the government. And so we petitioned EPA to do that. And finally, after years bouncing around in the courts and so forth, the Obama administration has proposed a coal ash rule, which is due to go final soon, which hopefully can finally make that declared a hazardous waste and require proper disposal.
Is this the regulation where the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has presented two different options?
That's exactly right. There's, to be a little technical about it, there are two options under RCRA, which is the Waste Disposal Statute. And one of them is a D, as in dog waste, and one is a C, as in cat waste. And we're arguing, or have argued, that coal ash needs to be treated as a C waste, which would make it hazardous. There's some modifications to that, as I said, that would allow truly beneficial reuses of the waste, which would avoid the hazardous label. But the D classification would essentially just leave this, once again, up to the states. And so far, that has proven inadequate.
That was Conrad Schneider, Advocacy Director with the Clean Air Task Force. For more information, call the organization's office in Boston at area code 617-624-0234 or visit their website at catf.us. Statistics released by the U.S. Census Bureau in September found that the percentage of Americans living below the poverty line in 2009 was the highest in 15 years at 14.3%. 44 million, or one of every seven Americans, was classified as poor, the highest level in 51 years. The increase in the poverty rate was highest for children, with one in five below the official poverty line. Understandably, most voters looking at the 2010 election are focused on the persistently high unemployment rate of nearly 10% and a painfully slow recovery. But with many polls predicting a major victory for Republicans seeking to gain control of Congress, an examination of economic policies advocated by GOP and Tea Party-backed candidates appear to run directly counter to the interests of working families. In order to stay afloat, millions of unemployed, underemployed, and disabled Americans have come to rely on government programs that some prominent conservative GOP candidates want to eliminate, such as unemployment insurance, Medicare, food stamps, and a federally mandated minimum wage. Further, echoing an unpopular position staked out by President Bush during his second term, many in the Republican Party are now pushing for the privatization of Social Security. Even as the number of Americans without health insurance rose from 46 million in 2008 to 51 million in 2009, Republicans have pledged to repeal President Obama's very cautious health care reform bill without advancing their own viable policy solution. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chuck Collins, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Program on Inequality and the Common Good. Here, he assesses increasing poverty in the U.S., growing income inequality, and what's at stake for economic policy in this year's congressional election.
Some of the progress that had been built over the 90s has been reversed. And, over the 90s, the poverty rate was going down steadily. The unemployment rate was going down, and we've had this reverse. And I think what I would say is that the great, economic meltdown, the Great Recession, has cast a very long shadow. We're going to see persistent unemployment. We're going to see persistent rising poverty. And what it actually translates into are things like the number of kids who are hungry and poor, who don't have the stability in their lives because their parents' employment situation is precarious, to be able to focus in school. It just has all kinds of costs that we don't always think about. So it's troubling because we really had made, over the last 30 years, more and more progress towards reducing poverty.
Well, Chuck, what about income and wealth inequality? It seems that with the recession, we're seeing a polarization of the country, a further polarization of the country between rich and poor, where those at the top have more and those in the middle and at the bottom of the economic strata have less.
Yeah, and that's been essentially the trend since the late 1970s. We're talking about poverty, but there's been an unusual concentration of wealth and income at the very top. And the higher up you go on the economic ladder, the more concentrated wealth there is. So really the top 1% of households has the greatest concentrations of wealth. The Great Recession didn't change that. In fact, I would argue that in some ways those inequalities contributed to the economic instability and the Great Recession. But that's been the trend. We basically are seeing a sort of pulling apart between top and bottom and a shrinking middle class, a much more precarious middle class.
In this congressional election year, we've got a lot of Republican and so-called Tea Party-backed candidates talking about getting rid of Social Security, Medicare, unemployment insurance, the minimum wage, getting rid of public education, and food stamps. And I'm wondering, isn't it ironic or odd that in this very dire economic time, when you would think the economic safety net is so much more important now than it has been in 70 years, that it's just the very opposite time that you'd want to shred and destroy the social safety net?
It's a curious thing. The more I talk and interview people from the Tea Party movement, you realize that there are quite a number of people who are in that movement who depend on government support, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, and the other, and yet they're lobbying for this limited government view. We get what we pay for. In terms of the quality of life and the health of our communities. And taxes are
the price you pay to live in a civilized and healthy community. So it's a fascinating dichotomy. And I think that, you know, the more some of these Tea Party candidates that were elected for local offices, some of them are now facing recall elections because they've come into office and they've laid off police and firefighters, and people in local communities are saying, hey, we want limited government, we want to pay less taxes, but we don't want you to cut all these services. Well, that's the reality. That's where the money's going.
In your mind, what's at stake for economic policy and income inequality in this 2010 congressional election? What should people keep in mind when they cast their ballots about these issues?
Well, we really are at a kind of key point that we don't want these inequalities, we don't want them to grow any wider, and we want to begin to reverse that so that we can have an economy that works for everybody, not just the very rich. And we're looking at an election where things could actually, I think, tilt towards what I would call more kind of corporate power. There's a lot of invisible money. An estimated $200 million have gone into issue advertisements through front organizations, through nonprofit C4 organizations that are buying advertising against certain candidates. And we won't know who the donors are. We'll never know who the donors are to some of those organizations. So it's a very dangerous time for our democracy that so much private wealth and power is tipping into that. So there's a lot at stake, and I think people hopefully will be engaged and vote and follow the issues and think about what's really in your long-term self-interest in terms of the health of your community and family and communities. You would think that after the economic meltdown 2 years ago, we would have kind of gotten a wake-up call and seen, okay, it's really in our interest to have basic social safety nets through which no one can fall. And there's still a lot of people, I think, that believe that. So that's how we should be thinking as we vote this November.
That was Chuck Collins, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Program on Inequality and the Common Good. Contact the group by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at extremeinequality.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our newly redesigned website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Melanie Muller, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.